Sometimes the word wildlife photography is very common now. Everyone is a wildlife photographer, and that's a good thing, I feel. You
Right.
know, people come to me and they are like, "Oh, photography is dying. Everyone is a photographer. This is the worst era." I feel like this is the best era to be a photographer, because in today's world, photography is not controlled by the media houses. Photography is not controlled by equipment. Everyone has a camera.
Yeah.
Everyone has access to technology. 50 years ago, 20 years ago, it was all about who has the understanding of dark room, who can actually create pictures and all of that. Today, photography is democratized. Now it is all about aesthetics. Now it is all about storytelling.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm so glad to be here because today's episode is absolutely fantastic. Now, we all live in the cities. Many of us may be living in smaller cities. In fact, now, if you live in India, there's a lot of ramping up of development, right? Small cities, which earlier were like, what? There's no food. I mean, that food, but now it's like it's got 50 McDonald's and it's got more McDonald's popping out of the McDonald's and it's got KFC coming out of Burger King's. It's crazy. And that's apparently the standard of development, right? Anyhow, standardized chains, or what do you call them, outlets across franchisees, have now become the benchmark of progress. Fucking great. But yeah, we talk about these things in cities, right? Very disconnectedly, like, oh my God, what's happening with the forest, the climate change, the environment. But is it disconnected? To find out more, I'm about to talk about today's guest, Prasenjit Yadav, who's a National Geographic photographer. He is a person who studies natural history. He documents it, he photographs it, and he's here today to talk about all these things that we question as urban dwellers. What is happening on the ground? What is climate change really affecting us? Is the human acts affecting the environment, the species? Well, in a nutshell, it is. And of course, what are we talking about? Climate change denial. What are we doing in these processes, right? So where can we chip in? Where does the disconnect happen? What is the projects he takes up? Why does he take it up? And what is that thing that sets these people apart, these explorers, the ones who climb Mount Everest, the ones who go out to the ultimate ends of human potential, the people who go and put themselves out there to report? Is it something that is beyond a human sense of curiosity? Is it a sense of personal kind of obsession? So to talk about this and a whole lot more, I've got Prasenjit. I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation. As someone who may live in the city or not, it brought me, and it's going to bring you closer to what is out there and what needs to be done by us and what is actually going on in the fringes of humanity, in the environments, the wilderness, in the wild species, in the wild plants that are dying off as we speak, but can also be preserved by our act. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Prasenjit Yadav. I appreciate you coming in every week, listening to this podcast. Appreciate it. Do tell a friend, do share the episode and subscribe to the channel and rate the podcast wherever possible. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it. Take care. Prasen, thank you so much for joining me on the Soapy Rao Show. It's a pleasure having you here today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. You know, you've been a busy man, and congratulations, I think, to start off. Congratulations in order for winning the Explorer Award by the National Geographic, which were recently awarded in New York.
That's something different. I'm an explorer with National Geographic, which happened like a decade ago. But there's another club in New York called as the Explorers Club, which is like the older version of exploration, where people like Buzz Aldrin and all of them are part of it. And that club is the one which had members who went to the North Pole first time, South Pole, Moon, Everest. So they pick 50 people every year as their next explorers. And I happen to be one of them. So thank you.
Brilliant.
For that.
Congratulations. Yeah. You know, it fascinates me when, you know, I read this book, which is a biography of George Mallory, right? This is by Jeffrey Archer, you know, documenting the life of George Mallory, who, you know, was, you know, debatably it's the first person to climb Mount Everest and reach the top, but that's not proven. So Edmund Hillary was, of course, the first person to do that, right? Along with, what's his name, Sherpa Tenzin. And when I read that, you know, they talk about Drake going to the poles, it just fascinates me to go to just understand what goes into the a personality, a character that is willing to put him or herself out there in such, especially back then, right, the with the limited resources and just with the human resilience to go to explore uncharted territories, whether it's going to the, you know, discovering a new land, whether it's discovering a new environment, whether it's going, and across the years, whether it's technology or whether things have gotten easier, there is a certain spark which separates certain humans apart from other human beings, certain humans like you, certain human beings like back in the day who did these things. And what is that you found in yourself that pushes you to go explore these new things?
Okay, we are diving right into it. I agree. And I've given it a good amount of thinking into this. And for the longest time, when I used to think about these people and when I used to not compare, but tally my behavior with some of the greats, I'm not there, but I used to think that they are passionate and I'm passionate too, which is what the route to getting to doing something substantial needs. But over the time, I've come to terms with it that what we do, what I did, what I do, or more than anything, what all these stalwarts have done does not need passion. Passion is cute in front of what they do. It's just sheer obsession.
Yeah.
People are mad. They just think of this and just this. And for the longest time, even now, when we think about obsession, it has a certain amount of negative connotation to it.
Yeah.
The reality is nothing substantial has been done in the past by anyone without that spark that you called. And that spark usually is obsession. People just get drawn into it and that's all they think about. And obsession can be of good things as well as bad things. And people can be obsessed and they can be standing on the buildings saying Kiran, and that's a negative kind of obsession. And then there are people who are exploring the reaches of our world and the universe, and they are obsessed about how the earth came into being. They are obsessed about the history of religion. They are obsessed about wildlife, and they are trying to, they're obsessed about saving that wildlife. It's all a kind of obsession which probably fits into more of a constructive obsession, I would say. And so I think it all boils down to obsession.
And in a time where we are flooded with people who are pursuing their passion, and we are constantly, I would say, confronted or affronted, but constantly exposed to that on social media platforms where everyone is a photographer, everyone is a traveler and an explorer in that context of things. I think separating these, this category of human beings is so essential, right? Because you don't have the glamour on you and the awards, which are, of course, granted, which are great, and that's recognizing the work you've done. But being in the field or being on that mountain slope where you're not getting, you know, 10,000 likes because you're being pushed on by that, but you're doing it, as you said, this constructive obsession to be on top of that tallest mountain or to capture that right image at the right time, at the right lighting, at the right thing. You don't know when you're shooting a tiger what the right kind of settings are going to be, and you're not going to be like, I'm going to capture it for the right filter and put it up for the right kind of validation online. So it's tremendous because there's hours of boredom, there's hours of just waiting, there's hours of pain in some context. So when people like you, when you decided to go, and you talked before we recorded, you a couple of phone calls, you said I'm out in the field setting traps, these camera traps, to go capture this right thing. So broadly speaking, of course, I want to get into the field of work that you specialize in, but when we have, you know, as my friend called it in the world of psychology, we have these pop psychologists who come online and just give you three ways in unqualified ways of how to overcome depression or how to save, you know, how to lose weight in 10 minutes. So people like you are genuinely doing the work out there. You're doing the grunt work. You're doing the grunt work of documenting stuff. You're doing the grunt work of exploring and discovering new stuff. So when you are putting out this research in whatever way you're documenting it, how deconstructive is these kinds of human beings going out there and just not, I don't know if they're doing a bad job or telling lies, but they're just doing it absolutely based on just validation and being recognized, as opposed to the quote unquote obsession for discovering or exploring or preserving or conserving certain, whether it's territories, whether it's geographies, whether it's species.
I think there are multiple questions here. First, it comes to what I guess you're asking about is validation and the social media and the passion and living your passion kind of thing that is going on. And that is a trend, I know. And it started like in advent of social media, like less than a decade ago. And to them, I feel like there are really good people, those who are doing that, who are doing it in a very tasteful and a constructive way. And I respect them. And I think they should keep doing that as long as the trend lasts. And there are people, those who tell lies, and I don't think about them. But how do I differentiate myself from them is that I was doing this before social media and before anyone cared about this. Yeah. And I would be doing this if tomorrow morning Instagram and social media and internet vanishes. Mm-hmm. I would still be doing exactly what I planned I'll be doing tomorrow and for the next rest of the year. So that's where I feel like I'm not in any way controlled by the validation that comes on social media, because I seek my validation from people, those who probably know this better than I do. Mm-hmm. I don't seek it from the crowd. And that doesn't mean that I mean the crowd. That just means that I want to create something that probably the crowd is not aware of. And for that, I have to seek validation from people, those who know this better than me or as much as I do. And then we create something that we put out that people learn about. And that's the reason why, for me, a platform like National Geographic Magazine or a lot of these outlets which have decades and decades of respect, which is governed by them from the world, when you put something out on those platforms, people believe that, people trust that, and it's not something that is done for validation. It has a educational purpose to it. It has a purpose which is beyond just I am a cool wildlife photographer. It goes way beyond that. Probably that's the first part of the answer. Now the second part is this set of people out there seeking and wanting to get their passion, does that impact me? I don't think so. I still do the same thing. And most of the times I tell stories which most of the people either can't, won't, or don't want to tell. Mm-hmm. And in that space, I still feel like I'm fine. I don't get affected. Sometimes the word wildlife photography is very common now. Everyone is a wildlife photographer. And that's a good thing, I feel.
Right.
You know, people come to me and they are like, oh, photography is dying. Everyone is a photographer. This is the worst era. And I feel like this is the best era to be a photographer, because in today's world, photography is not controlled by the media houses. Photography is not controlled by equipment. Everyone has a camera, yeah. A good camera on their phones. Everyone has access to technology. 50 years ago, 20 years ago, it was all about who has the understanding of darkroom, who can actually create pictures and all of that. Today, photography is democratized. Now it is all about aesthetics. Now it is all about storytelling. And I think that's the beauty of it. You are not restricted by the technology or the media houses or gatekeepers. You are restricted by your own creativity. So I think this is the best era to be a photographer.
Nicely said, yeah. No, I remember back in maybe the late 90s, it's also like the access to technology was the access to travel, right? Because getting cameras here were at huge costs at import duty. And I remember my granddad, he used to love traveling, love photography, and he would bring back these things, and it was just fascinating to look at these cameras. It was the Olympus, and I remember another one, which was, he called the spy camera, right? I'm like, why is my granddad with the spy camera? Like, what's this old man getting up to? It was quite fascinating. Just look at him play around with those lenses. It was quite cool. And he would treat that with such awe, right? Like the lens would be clean, put in this, and it was all leather cases back then. Like now, of course, it's great. I mean, I love the access that it's there for people, but the way he would keep it, and for the longest time, you know, we were just, after he passed away, we kept it because it's just like, wow, even though I'm not a photographer.
It's nostalgia.
Even if I showed photos, I mean, it'll be pretty blurred. But anyhow, see, you mentioned this very important thing. I remember when I was a kid, we would have the subscription to the National Geographic magazines. They'd be coming home, and the, you know, I can still remember, like, you know, with the, I had more vision back then, but seeing these gloss page images of these photographers going to these African tribes, or these shots of the cheetah in full sprint. And I mean, they're just timeless imprints on your mind, you know? And as a result, they do attract the best talent in the world when it comes to, you know, whether it comes to wildlife photographers or wildlife journalists. And that's amazing that they're able to keep up that standard in a time that's rapidly changing. And a lot of sources of information have been now distributed, right? Whether it's in the financial space, whether it's in the reporting news space, you see a lot of these things have lost their trust. The public have lost their trust in these organizations. But it's amazing to hear that these organizations like the National Geographic have retained their trust and still can report and document our natural habitat, our natural world around us. So that leads me to asking you, when we report cultural, political, economic news or economic happenings, there is a certain interpretation of the truth, and there are certain versions of the truth that are being bought and sold, and people are aligning to those various things. But when you are reporting and documenting the natural world, and as you specialize in natural history, it is a world around us that is has been around before we were here, and is going to be around here way after we are here. So what is the responsibility you have, and what is the intention you have when you're going into a space like this? Because it is, at the end of the day, a perception of a world from a human's eye versus a world that is timeless in some sense compared to the amount of time we have spent here.
That's a good question. I feel like this is something of a friend of mine who's a very well-known photographer told me once when I got my first assignment. He looked at me and he's like, "You know what that means? That means that out of millions and millions and millions of people who want to do this, you are the one who have gotten an opportunity. Mm. And would you want to treat it as an opportunity?" And immediately what came to my mind, I was like, no, this is the responsibility. And I still treat each of my story as a responsibility, because not everyone gets this chance. I am getting a chance to tell a story about snow leopard, which is one of the most charismatic, elusive big cat species that exists and that walks on this planet. And I'm just happy to be alive in the same era when snow leopard is walking our planet, and I get to tell its story. So what do I do? Do I make few trips and settle to it? Or do I just move up in mountain at 5,000 meters in minus 30 degrees? Mm-hmm. I just move up, and I spend 3 years speaking to locals, to people, those who are conserving them, to the scientists, to the researchers. I read everything, and I spend time with that species in the ecosystem that it lives in to first form my own opinion, to form my own understanding based on the knowledge that I've collected to tell its story. And how it works is in science and in journalism, now there's this new term, not new, there's this term called as helicopter journalism or helicopter science. Mm-hmm. And there is helicopter storytelling as well. Mm-hmm. And I am not one of those. Mm-hmm. I don't just go in, create a 15-second reel and come out and seek validation. No, that's not my job.
You don't take a selfie with the snow leopard, right? That's not something
I don't think. I mean, of course, I do that too. But right. It's for me that on this day, I was so close to the snow leopard. It's not for showing off. The moment you realize that, exactly, that's the difference, I would say.
Yeah.
Where you are telling that story because you want to show off, and when you are telling that story because it's a responsibility. I think that is what puts certain people completely apart from rest of the people. And that is not better or it's not like I'm better than them. I'm just different.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is a different thing. And maybe there will be a time when I would want to do that as well for certain, some other reason.
Yeah.
But when I'm on assignments, my job is not to show off, but to show the reality and make people aware of the story that probably they might not know, and help them understand that how this snow leopard living up at 5,000 meters in the Himalaya in minus 30 degrees impacts a person living in Mumbai, Bangalore, New Delhi, or New York. And I think if I manage to do that part of my job, I think if I manage to do that, my job is done. That is make people relate, make people care, make people understand. That is one part. And the second part is, yes, National Geographic does give that voice. They have retained their reputation. And the whole point is that when I pick a story, I spend anywhere between 1 to 3 years working on it. So it becomes part of my life. And when I start living with the locals who are sharing space with those big cats or those species, the moment I start feeling that I don't know enough, that's when I feel like, okay, now I'm ready to speak about it, because right. I have already broken that superficial layer and I've gotten into the depths of it where I know that each answer leads to three more questions. I think that's when I'm comfortable that, hey, this is what we found. This is what I found. This is what we have no clue about. That's one thing. The second thing when I'm doing these stories, which probably sets me or sets my kind of people apart, is that we really have people included in these stories. That when my story is ready, I usually probably show it to the people, those who are living with those species. They are the first viewers of it. And if they are excited about it, if they are like, oh, you did a good job documenting our story, then what becomes is I'm mere a vessel that is carrying this story to the world. And I like to be the vessel for the story for the world. And when that happens, that's when I take it to the world. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, I think you did, because
I thought it was on the similar lines.
No, I think you did, because I'm quite fascinated, right, by this world, which I'm not privy to because of the circumstances. I live in the city. I was raised in the city. And I think I'm thankful for the life I have. But it's alien to me what you're talking about. I have, of course, been to Bandipur. I've been to Nagar Hole. I've been on these wildlife safaris. And, you know, in some way, it's a glimpse of, a world which I'm not a part of. But again, reading Wilbur Smith's books and his accounts of Africa, it's glorious, right? But again, it's very easy to sit here listening to it in Bangalore in the comfort of my home with the fan on, the air conditioning on, without bugs biting me. And it's lovely that I have the opportunity to read and listen and maybe even go on a four-day holiday in, you know, one of these places which has been set up on the fringes of the forest. But, you know, when we are sitting here as armchair philosophers, armchair environmentalists in the city, especially in the cities across the world, we are driven into sort of a frenzy by the media, right? But especially with now the idea of global warming, climate change, and the impact that human activities and human impact on environment. And as a result, again, we form into teams, right? Pro, anti, deniers, various kinds of groups. But when you go into these environments for various projects, and I want to ask you also how you pick these projects later, when you meet the people on the front lines of human wildlife conflict or human the impact of, say, factories and CO2 levels on their environment, where there's a lot of topsoil removal, or there's a lot of these things happening in various climates, right? On the hills, there's certain things going on. People on the coast experience certain things. And again, this is from me coming as a layperson. What is the real impact on ground to animal species, to wildlife species, to plant species from your eyes? What have you witnessed over the past 20 years?
First things first, just because you're living in Bangalore or I'm living in Nagpur, Bangalore, wherever, in Delhi, does not mean that I'm completely removed from these species and these ecosystems.
Right.
Your life in Bangalore and my life in Nagpur or Delhi is better because of these ecosystems. The air we breathe comes from these ecosystems. The water we drink, most of the major rivers originate in these ecosystems. And these ecosystems are part of the species, and the species are part of those ecosystems. And what we do in cities may it be New Delhi or New York, impacts these ecosystems. So we are all connected. I think the first thing we really need to know is we are not some individuals living in a silos on this planet. Mm-hmm. We are all connected. The day I was born, I have become a carbon footprint, and I can't unbond myself. But I can choose to live a certain life where I'm trying to be mindful about it. Does not mean that I have to stop living. Does not mean that. It does not mean that that I know that there are pro and there are con and there are people who are against it. There's nothing to be against that the planet is warming up, that climate is changing. There's hard data collected by scientists over decades, which clearly shows that climate is changing. If you do not accept it, you really need to read up and accept that you're choosing not to accept it, which is fine as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one can come with the data to denounce this anymore, because 99.99% of the global science community agrees that climate is changing, and that is because of human intervention. It is because of human activity. It's not some natural causes. Yes, in the past, when you look at evolutionary timescale, climate climate has changed on our planet at different times, but not at the pace at which it is changing right now.
Mm-hmm. Post-industrialization,
it is changing right now. Post-industrialization is entirely because of us. And if we don't want to accept it, it's still going to impact us. We accept it or not accept it. That's the reality. And as much as it is impacting us, it is definitely impacting the species. There's a report which shows that there have been 50% of the species that existed have gone extinct in the last 500 years. That existed on our planet before. I think the number is much higher. I'm saying this conservatively just because I don't remember the exact number. In the last 20 years, since I've started working and since I've started documenting this, I myself have seen forests go away, which I had photographed 15 years ago. I myself have witnessed it. I have witnessed species going extinct that I had photographed 12 years ago, and that species probably is not there on this planet today. So, yes, it is scary. We relate to a murder of a human being because it's our species, but the conservationists, researchers, all the people who are aware and take interest into knowing the natural world, they witness this murder on a regular basis, and it is heartbreaking. At the same time, I'm one of those hopelessly hopeful kind of people. Yeah. And I like to believe that that yes, we have messed up, but at the same time, I like to believe that we as a species are going to make a difference. We are the one who screwed it up. We are the one who are going to fix it. And it is going to take time. Things might get worse than they are before they start getting better. But there's no denying this. And yes, the wildlife does not have does not understand or speak English to say this to us in words, but they are feeling this, and they are expressing in their own languages that this is enough.
And you know, that's the most important thing, which I think you addressed, besides of course the fact that every life form will express in its own way when it's experiencing distress, or when it's facing extinction, or when it's facing adverse conditions. And I think people like you are the voice in some way, you know, the representatives to the human beings, because of course it's not all about us, but we are the ones causing the activities that are contributing to such rapid change, you know, on the environment around us. But you know, I find it quite important that you mentioned the connection that we all have with every aspect of this, right? Whether it's the water, the soil, whether the food we eat. But there's this sense of disconnect that has happened. And that's why I mentioned sitting in Bangalore as an armchair thing, because we can sit here and we can kind of get, you know, kind of mired in our own city problems. Like, oh, traffic is so bad. It's so hot. Why is the current gone? There's no power for, you know, 24 hours. And that's just sort of something that we become numb to, right? That like we think of the forest, we think of the creeks, as you mentioned, or we think of these huge ancient forests as something like almost romantically, like, wow, it'd be lovely to look at that. You know, wouldn't it be great? But, you know, clearly, as a person who would love to be a part of, you know, something where we can restore this, just for the sake of the fact that it is something so rich and part of our planet, I find it, you know, confusing, because, you know, we certain actions of ours, unknowingly or knowingly by certain people, have caused this thing, right? Whether it's deep sea mining, whether it's deforestation for timber, whether it's deforestation for mineral mining, whatever it may be. But since we know this now, why are we consciously committing acts of mass murder, if you want to call it? Like, I don't know if this is connected to your work, but I was reading about the practice of the grind, as they call it in the what islands are those near Denmark, in the Faroe Islands, and I'm sure you've heard of even the whaling in Japan, right, where they go with pilot whale hunting or whale dolphin hunting. So while we're already doing so much damage, why are we consciously not preventing these? Because we use things like, oh, it's a part of their culture, it's a part of their thing. But while there's so much unconscious damage happening through these large-scale industry, can we at least in some way reduce the intentional harm we're causing?
I think that's a very good question. When you said that there are certain people, I want to come on record and say this, and I've been very mindful when I say this, that I don't do those people and me. I feel like I'm part of the problem too. I'm not excusing myself out of it just because I'm telling these stories. I'm right now sitting on a computer, which is a MacBook Pro. I'm speaking to you on the internet. I'm consuming electricity. I just took a flight to go to National Geographic for a meeting. So I'm part of the problem too. I'm trying to reduce it, but at the same time, I can't excuse myself out of it. And I'm the consumer, and the providers are providing what consumers want, and consumers are consuming what the providers are giving. And it's a catch-22 in which we are fixed into right now. The fossil fuel problem is the classic catch-22 as well, because it's cheaper, so I want it. I want it, so they're giving it. And I think there are two ways how this catch-22 is going to break, how this loop is going to break. And one is philosophical and one is more practical, but both are equally important. The first thing is the need and want to change. And that need and want to change, to bring better practices, is going to come when people are going to start empathizing. I think there is no information gap. People are reading this. Okay, the good, the bad, the ugly, all people are reading this. They all know climate is changing. They all see whales dying. They have lost the feeling of it. And I think that gap I call is the empathy gap. Mm-hmm. And that is what I work on. I work on bridging the empathy gap that exists between humans and rest of the planet. And that is what is going to help us want to make the change. And once we want it, I think we are a species who have extreme abilities to move things forward using technology. And I think how will be answered by technology. I think technology can figure out a way to replace fossil fuels with solar and better solar. It's going to figure out a way to how to make travels less harmful and more climate friendly. It's going to help us figure out how to get our food more sustainable. So I think it's a combination of bridging the empathy gap and advancing and investing more into the climate friendly or other species friendly technology. I think it's the combination of these two which is going to help us move things forward. Do you see what I'm saying? I, 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 I truly believe that this is where a right combination of these two is what is going to help solve the mess that we are in.
Right. No, and I think, you know, as a reporter and someone documenting our history and our natural history, which we're a part of, you know, we can't just say human history and natural history, because that's kind of silly, right? That we are in some way a different part of this planet, and as a result, not in sync with it. But when you report this, or choose what to report, because it seems never ending, right? As someone who's chosen to get away from conventional research in maybe the lab or maybe the office or wherever you do your research, to get out there, it's a big decision. So how do you prioritize which project to take up? Or, for instance, you mentioned the snow leopard project you're working on. Could you talk about your process of what criteria are you looking for, or what drives you to a certain project? Is it the need of the hour? Is it something which is the dire straits of that community or the species? Or is it something which is a personal preference? Say, I have a love for tigers, which I want to see through.
So I get projects in two ways. One is when I get commissioned that, hey, we want you to go in Northeast India and photograph these living root bridges, which are these ficus trees, and tell a story about it.
Yeah.
And I mostly do them. And they are commissioned, they are need of the art, which the industry wants, and industry is like, Prasin is the right person to do this. Here you go, do it for us. But those projects are usually shorter. Those projects have very limited budgets. Those projects are quick turnaround kind of projects. And I do them because I know how to get things done quickly. But the bigger projects, which I put my heart and soul into, are mostly personal projects. They are the project that I choose because I want to do it. And early on, I figured out that I cannot pick a project which is extremely important right now, but my heart is not into it. Because if I have to do something for 2-3 years and invest my savings into it and give my life to it, I should do something that I feel that I can be obsessed about. Mm. So most of these personal projects or these larger projects that I'm speaking about are projects that I'm drawn towards, that I'm mad about, and I keep doing them till they burn me out.
How do you get funding for these things? Because it is, at the end of the day, it is lovely to hear that, you know, you're going behind it till you're burning out. But practically, you need the equipment, you need the resources to sustain yourself. So are there philanthropic organizations doing this? Are they, is it like obviously the National Geographic? So how do you get funding? How do you secure funding before you set out on this 3-year project?
Yeah. The shorter commission projects are straightforward, where you're commissioned by a media house and media house is like, here's X amount of money. Mm-hmm. This is the budget. This is your salary. Get this done. And that's straightforward. I don't think those commission projects are some of my best works, because many of these naturalistic stories needs a lot of time.
Yeah.
And if you are doing it in a very specific amount of time, then you're left to... Then the luck is what comes into the role, that in that 2 weeks, mm-hmm. you have to get lucky to witness something. And that's when your camera should work and you should work and it should be happening in front of you and you should be there. Da, 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 da. There are just layers of things that need to happen at the right time. But the personal projects are something which are a mix of all of this. There are, when I pick up a larger assignment for which I know that I'm definitely going to work at least for a year, year and a half, or maybe, I don't know how long it is going to go. There's some money that's coming from the commission. There's some money which I raise through grants. A lot of grants are there, national as well as international. I work a lot with researchers, locals. What I do is every now and then I do commercial projects. Right. Like I film for BBC. I'm a cinematographer. I go out in the field. They are like, this is a species. We want you to film. And it pays pretty well. So I have my own savings, which I fueled into these personal projects. And then there are like philanthropists who are like, hey, you know what? We really like what you're doing. We want to invest in you. And I'm like, I don't want money. Why don't you buy that gear for this project, for this thing? So it's a mix of all of that. which you really need to put yourself out into to get those right pictures or get those right narratives out in the world. So it cannot be done if you are just passionate about it. It has to be done when you're obsessed and you can convince others that this obsession is worth putting your time, energy, and money into.
So you are obsessed with these things which you are documenting, telling a story about, factually verifying certain things, and in some way preserving for our future generations, which is, you know, in itself remarkable. I think it's I think, needless to say, I don't think I'm going to patronize you by saying great work, good job, but I just think it need to say it's an amazing body of work. But what are some of the memories for you which are embedded in you, which have left a mark on you? If you could share a couple of those, I think it'll be I think, because end of the day, yes, of course, you're helping the species that you are covering, you are reporting their plight, you're talking about the way they've been impacted over the past how many ever years you're covering. But what about you, the human? What about you, Prasenjit or Preston? What do you feel when you're doing this? What are some of the memories they have had on you, which you're going to carry forward in your life?
It's a good question. To respond to the first part of what you said, there was a time when I really used to feel and believe that I'm very passionate about this, and I'm passionate because it's the important work the world needs to know. And by doing this job, I'm actually contributing. I'm probably saving the species, or I'm helping people save the species, or I'm equipping the activist or the conservationist or the scientist or the policymakers by bringing these stories to them. And it was beautiful because it was all driven by passion. And at some point, I came to understanding, or the change happened that I realized I'm just obsessed about this. Mm. And all these things are not that they don't happen. They are true, that each of my story have had impacts beyond just the readership. But probably I don't do it for that anymore. I just do this because I want to and I like to. And if I don't do this, I probably won't know what else to do. Mm. And I know this sounds dark, but at the same time, that's the reality. If I am not true to this fact that I'm doing this for me, then I won't be able to take the next step of how can I do this beyond me.
Yeah.
So I have come to terms, I have accepted that I do this not to save the species. That's the outshoot of it. I do this because I want to be out there. I like to be miserable. I like to trouble myself. I like to spend hours and days and months in this extreme weather. And I know it all sounds rosy and romantic. This kid who grew up in this small village close to Nagpur in the jungle, came out of there, went to school somehow, found himself in this institute called as National Center for Biological Sciences, which is like the most premier research institute in the country. Left PhD, started photography, became a Nat Geo photographer. And it all sounds romantic. And I know that, I'm aware of it. But that romantic part is like the 5% of the reality of me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get confused in the idea of me. The reality of me is 60% is just misery.
Right.
And I'm not even like exaggerating. It's just the reality. And if I'm not doing this for me, then it's too hard to sustain that, maintaining this misery or keep going through this misery again and again and again and again. Of course, there's motivation beyond me, but it starts with me. And that's the reason why I pick stories which I want to do. And then if I want to do and I'm obsessed about it, then of course, those other things just fall in place where I connect with right people, the right scientists, the right managers, and I end up creating things that in turn becomes useful for them to push the cause forward of saving the species or saving the ecosystem or educating people. But that all is like a secondary thing. And in no way I want to tap my back saying that I'm saving the world. It might be happening, but I'm not doing it consciously. The only thing I'm doing consciously is picking stories which I want to be obsessed about.
Right. And can you, you know, it's great in the cities, we're sitting here listening to podcasts and meditation apps about how to be happy, how to be joyful, and you're sitting there saying, I love being miserable. I love it. I just no, but can you talk about a couple of those instances which have left a mark on you?
Again, I think this entire idea that is sold to the world that, oh, we have to be happy, I think that's rubbish. No one can be constantly happy perpetually. It's just not real.
Yeah.
Like if there are multiple emotions and their combination is what makes life beautiful the way it is. And my way of looking at any assignment is, or anything that I'm doing, is through this thing where I think of it as 33%. That first 33% is yay, this is exciting. And then there's 33% where it's like, meh, it is what it is, I have to get this done. And then there's 33% which is misery. So it's happiness, misery, and meh. I think mix of all of them is what makes any conversation or anything important or interesting. So yes, I think if I let go of that misery part, then there's something off. Or if the misery is 90%, then there's something wrong.
Right.
So it has to be a good balance. And yes, there have been instances, chased by an elephant. I've seen a tiger charged by a tiger. Seen a king cobra very close by, and all those things. But I think what if I have to tell a few good and few bad experiences, the bad experiences are from the snow leopard assignment where everyone thought that this person goes into, I was working in this small tiny hamlet of 10-15 villages, 10-15 houses in a village, and there was no phone, no electricity. And during the peak winter months of couple of months, and you have to walk like 15-20 kilometers to make one phone call or something like that. And everyone was like, it must be so physically draining. And the reality is, it's very easy to deal with the physical hardship. Those kind of assignments become more of a mental game where you are not letting yourself slide into the depression that comes with isolation, that comes with loneliness, that comes from despair or not knowing what you're doing or why you're doing it. It's so easy. I think those are the harder things that people like me have to deal with. And of course, when you're working on systems like this, ecosystems like this, the sheer and pure happiness comes from seeing a species that you haven't seen in your life before. And getting a great encounter, a great experience of seeing, like, I've had a privilege of sitting with a snow leopard for hours, just me and the snow leopard. And the snow leopard was like 50, 60 feet away. And he was on a kill. He was eating. He would look at me. I would look at him. And in those 2.5 hours, 3 hours, I think I took 6 photos or 5 photos because every time I would click, the leopard would look at me because he could hear the shutter from my camera. And I would never forget those hours. I've been on these isolated islands in Indian Ocean photographing species that live only on those islands, and those sunrises, those sunsets. And of course, there's a reason that I can deal with that 60% of misery, because that 10% of beauty is just too much to handle.
It's a moment with God.
And it's totally worth it. It's moment with yourself where you feel like, oh, 60% of misery was totally, totally worth it. I would do it again 10 more times.
You know, we seek that, right? I mean, this is just, it brings kind of goose flesh to me, like just trying to be in your shoes. I can't even imagine, but just when that snow leopard is chomping away and it's like, dude, can you not like photograph me? I'm a little shy when I'm eating kind of feeling, right? It's just beautiful. But wow. You know, when we talk about a spiritual connection to something bigger than us, some people find it in meditation, in a space, in the mountains when they're in a retreat, so many places where they find it. But would you say these moments, you said, indescribably beautiful moments, whether it's 2.5 hours with a species you've just discovered, or a sunset or a sunrise on an island which is not inhabited by fellow human beings. Would that be your, I won't say escape, but would that be your sense of release from your body?
I have lived in the Himalayas and deep forests and isolation, and I don't think I'm spiritual that way, but from what I have read how people perceive spiritualism, I probably don't know about it, but yes, I do feel a part of where I am. I do feel a part. I do feel responsible, and I do feel extremely small when I am in these ecosystems. And maybe that is spiritualism. That is probably a way of it. I don't know. Maybe I don't know how to articulate it. But yes, probably I experience it in my own different way. And I definitely am. I'm in love with it, and that's the reason why I keep finding ways to be there. I keep finding ways to keep doing that. I keep finding ways to experience it more and more. And I wouldn't know what to do when time comes when I wouldn't be able to experience it. I have to figure out a way. Maybe that's when I go for Vipassana or something and find the normal way of spiritual.
I like how you call that the normal way. For us mere mortals, yeah, just go to an ashram.
I mean the conventional way. Lovely. Let me put it that way.
I like it. No, don't change it. I like it. Okay, I'm going to depart from what we've been speaking for just a couple more points before I let you go. We hear of all these things that, you know, you of course cover wildlife and wild species and places where there are not too many humans, or the fringes of humanity, if you want to call it. But then we hear of these arguments for and against domesticated animals, right? Whether it's for meat consumption. And recently I was reading somewhere where there have been mandates for a lot of farmers across Europe to cull their livestock because of the carbon footprint that's having. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you hear of people who are anti-factory farms, and people who are pro-vegetarian diets. And then you hear of people in other group, multiple groups here, who are pro-hunting, saying that I will catch my own meat, I will kill my own elk or my own moose, depending on which region they live in. So as someone who's an observer, a documenter, what is this particular, our food habits, especially whether it's vegetarian, whether it's vegan, whether it's meat eaters, and what does that impact? Because you briefly did speak about food and how we should be, you know, a combination of empathy and also technology, which will save us from ourselves. But in the present day, there's so much noise about what we eat. And what is your take on that? If you,
that's a very, very deep, and probably that needs another hour long conversation. But in a nutshell, I would say that each individual have to be mindful and have to read and understand where their food comes from. I have met people who are against meat eating. I mean, you all know them. But at the same time, I've met people who are like full-time meat eaters and have way less carbon footprint than those vegetarian people. So right. I think it is not so simple of good and bad. It is way more complex than that. I mean, it's not about, oh, you eat chicken and I'm better than you because I'm eating avocado, which is probably flown from South America to India, or I'm better than you because I'm eating meat, because which is killed by me in my backyard. I don't think it's that simple. I still believe that food that is locally grown, maybe meat or maybe vegetarian food, which is locally grown, which is where you know where it is coming from and it's not mass produced, I think it's fine. And I am slowly trying to work towards not eating meat when I'm in these big cities. When I'm in some small tiny hamlet up in the mountains where they have grown their sheep and they are eating it with respect, I have no problem with it. Absolutely not. At the same time, I have no problem with like India is a country where you can be vegetarian whenever, wherever you want in most part of the country. I grew up being vegetarian most of the time. We used to make meat like once in a month or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So I have grown eating veg as well. But at the same time, I think I am a little concerned about this idea of I eat better than you, so I'm better than you.
Yeah.
Which just seems a little off.
Yeah,
I don't know if I answered your question, but in the nutshell, it is about knowing where your food is coming from and is it sustainable.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't asking for a solution.
I spent like a month on this completely isolated island, which is probably the remotest island in the world, in Indian Ocean. And I had a bunch of people with me who would hunt and catch fish and eat it. I never ate because somehow in my mind, I long ago decided that I wouldn't eat seafood because most of it is wild meat. But I know that eating that fish there on that island was extremely sustainable. It was a choice I made beyond the knowledge. At the same time, So it is complex, and I'm also forming my thoughts about it. I do eat meat. I eat chicken. I eat goat. Mostly in the places where I know that the chicken and goat is grown literally locally, and it's around me.
Okay. Now, I wasn't the reason. I just wanted you to weigh in with your thoughts because you're someone who's kind of connected with the natural world. And sometimes, again, it's the armchair things, right? This is bad. That is bad. And there's so many articles you can read to defend your position or to justify your thing. So this is just more of a human touch to what you feel. And I didn't expect you to. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I wanted. And thanks for sharing that.
And I have just had to it. I've been with hunter gatherers, those who literally hunt wild meat and eat it, and I really don't judge them either, because what they are doing is in that place is hardly making a dent on the it is what they have been doing for ages, which is what they are doing now. Things get worse or bad when these hunter gatherers are equipped with modern weapons and they are hunting beyond what they need, and it goes to markets to sell to people who are living in cities, or you know, that's where it gets unsustainable. And that is the difference between hunting, gathering and
poaching, right?
poaching for commercial purposes, you know? So I think there's a lot of judgment associated with it as well, but.
Yeah. I think human greed again, right? Because if you take away that element of the sustainable practice, which is hunting the way they did, and add technology, next thing you know, they're like, hey, why shouldn't I, you know, kill 20 elephants and harvest their tusks because I'm getting money. I've never seen this money. What am I going to do with the money? God alone knows, but I can do it. It's again a human trait, which, you know, you can't deny anyone that human trait, right? So it's across the board. You can't say people in the city are evil, people in the tribes are lovely liberated souls, and vice versa. I think it's a balance of everyone needs that empathy, whether you speak it in the language which is common or whether you speak it from your heart. I think that's something which I think you beautifully captured early on. So I think, you know, it's just been a fantastic conversation. I think it's been informative in some way. It's also, you know, taken away this thing that I have no say over anything because I'm sitting in Bangalore or in a city. But I think bringing this connection, which you did early on in the episode, is really, really important. So thanks for that. And I think just thanks for sharing all your experiences, your knowledge on the issue. And I think, I think on behalf of everyone listening, I think thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me on this. It was lovely speaking to you. Those were great questions. And I'm happy because usually the questions are, how did you end up becoming an agri photographer? Or tell us more about this story or that story. This was so much deeper than those usual questions which people can actually Google and find online. So thank you for making this conversation interesting for me as well.
Thanks, Prasenji. That means a lot because, as I told you before we recorded, you know, I can search you. I can search your accolades. I can search your awards. But it's as you mentioned, there's a thing, there's a spark, and I wanted you, and I wanted that spark to know what that spark is. So thanks for opening up to me and allowing me to ask these questions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it.